Okay. Next case for argument is Hartress versus Endicott. Mr. Richards.
Good morning. May it please the court, counsel. David Hartress appears today asking that the district court be failure to grant a writ of habeas corpus be overturned based upon a breach of the plea agreement. We state that there are two breaches to the plea agreement based upon the prosecutor who was appearing at the sentencing when he referred to multiple other acts involving the same defendant, E, and the second breach, more importantly, when he referred to other victims, either two or three other victims, that Mr. Hartress supposedly had sexual contact or intercourse with. This came up through a letter that was provided to the court by the victim, E's mother. And what is significant is when this sentencing was occurring, the prosecutor told the state court, Judge Froelich, that these were agreed to be taken as true. They were read-ins, which is a term in Wisconsin.
Yeah, but that was corrected, right, by your lawyer, by your...
It was not timely corrected by the trial court, and it was never objected to, and the district court,
But the lawyer immediately said he didn't, in fact, concede these other incidents. And so even if the prosecutor was out of line, how can we find the Wisconsin court's conclusion that this... failure by the prosecutor was prejudicial, particularly secondarily in light of the fact that had the prosecutor only referred to it in the right way, if the prosecutor had said, and there are allegations that, it could have been before the judge.
I think, one, when in the opinions it said immediately corrected, it was not immediately corrected. It was not addressed until approximately five pages later in the transcript when he began his sentencing remarks. He did not say that the prosecutor was wrong.
Why is there any constitutional duty to interrupt someone else? That's what your argument seems to come down to.
Well, I think
the lawyer disputed the prosecutor at length, made it perfectly clear that these allegations were not agreed to, and you then say, well, but it wasn't immediate.
There was never
whether, A, where's the constitutional command to leap to your feet and punch out the prosecutor to stop him from talking? Or why would it make any difference when the judge, before he imposes the sentence, knows the defense position?
Because, one, a timely objection, if not raised timely, creates waiver, which, if it was dealt with in a timely fashion...
No, there's no contention here that the trial judge said, you waited too long to make this point.
Your Honor...
The trial judge, in fact, said it didn't make any difference to him.
He didn't say that at the sentencing. He said that at the post-judgment hearing much later. And the case that I rely on, Santabella, doesn't talk about what the judge says he took into his mind, because that's a burden that the defendant and the defense counsel can never prove. We know that he took it into consideration because he sentenced on it.
There is a constitutional command that defense counsel must be impolite.
I'm not saying that there is one.
Prosecutor, rather than wait his turn and then make his point, which is what defense counsel did.
If someone is going to misstate a plea agreement on the record, all one has to do is say, Your Honor, I object. That is a misstatement of the plea agreement. Unfortunately, it happens all too often, and you stand up and you say it. You deal with the problem when it arises. You don't deal with it at a later date, hoping that this is all going to sort itself out 2 years later.
So if you make an error in your talk, you expect the other side to leap up and say, Court of Appeals, stop listening to him, start listening to me. And indeed, there might be a constitutional obligation for you to interrupt the state's lawyer as he is talking to us rather than wait your turn?
I think a trial court is much different than the court.
It might be more effective to wait, actually, because then you can present your coherent argument at the point where the judge is closer to making
just
a decision.
Well, I find that position somewhat difficult.
Let me put it this way. I understand the argument that during a trial, when a lawyer is asking a question, states have a contemporaneous objection rule. But I see no evidence that Wisconsin has a contemporaneous objection rule for arguments being made to the judge in the course of a sentencing proceeding, rather than a rule that says people wait and talk in turn.
Well, one of the cases that the state relies on in its brief, and I think misrelies in its brief, is Knox. And there it talks about the breach being cured by the prosecutor being immediately objected to. There was a recess taken. The problem was dealt with. The prosecutor then came back and said, I'm sorry, I misstated the plea agreement. And they then went forward, and when that defendant alleged prejudice, it was found not to be. That's not this case. And in this case, the judge did not say anything about the objection, the position. It was referred to as a read-in. And when he sentenced, we know that he took it into consideration. And what would a defendant rather be in a position of? One defendant, one victim, multiple occasions, or a serial pedophile having one defendant, having multiple victims,
well,
three or four?
I'm not sure I can agree with you that we know that the judge took this into account. He didn't impose a higher maximum sentence because of conceded things. He stayed within the sentence for the charged conduct. He did have the conditions referring to children, but he could have done that anyway if the prosecutor had used the wording that I suggested you couldn't be objecting to, namely, there have been allegations of, you know, very often in these child abuse cases, judges will impose restrictions vis-a-vis all children. They're not trying to protect only one child. They want to protect all children. So I'm not sure we can draw the inference that you're trying to draw from the wording of the judgment.
I'm not talking about the judgment. I'm talking about the judge's very brief statement at sentencing, which he refers to victims, not victim. He refers to victims and refers to them as they. So it's quite clear that he took the position of the prosecutor who was appearing at sentencing when he referred to them as read-ins.
Well, he only says victims once, and then he has actually a lengthy statement where he's talking about, you've heard the words of your daughter indicating that what you did to her should bring about life imprisonment, and he goes on. I mean, it seems to me he knows what's happening, and he hears the lawyer's correction about what's conceded and what isn't, and our standard of review, as you well know, is a narrow one.
I understand that, but just briefly in response, the judge's total sentencing remarks in this case are approximately 3.5 pages. 2 pages of those remarks are boilerplate that a judge in Wisconsin must read to a defendant who's been sent to prison. There's really the time he gives them, and then one paragraph regarding conditions. And in that one paragraph, he refers to them as victims and they, showing that he clearly did. He didn't say, I am doing it to...
Well, he could have found that, I imagine, as a fact, even without a concession as well.
I think he could have ordered the alleged victims. I think he could have ordered anything he wanted. But the fact is that that's not what happened.
So he now it's the omission of the word alleged, to use the plural that you're focusing on?
No, I don't believe that. That would make, I think, the government's argument stronger, in the sense that in Santabella, we're not talking about prejudice. We're looking at a breach. There's clearly a breach. There's a breach admitted by everybody. And what we're arguing about is materiality. And what I'm saying is those words show the materiality in the transcript. And the judge can at a later date do his post hoc justification and say, it didn't matter to me, and the defendant's left holding the bag. Why can't the state, when they walk into court, be prepared and do it right?
Yeah, but I would also say, why is it you're asking us, a federal court of appeals, to place no weight on what the district judge said or the trial judge said later on in the post-conviction? I mean, you're asking us to say, oh, well, you couldn't know that anyway.
In Santabella, it says that they don't have to go back. And in Santabella, at the time of the sentencing, the judge says, there's a breach, but it doesn't matter. I didn't consider it. I could do whatever I want. You don't even have that in this case. You wait until the post-judgment. Thank you.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Richards. Mr. Weber?
Members of the court, good morning. There simply was no breach of the plea agreement in this case. The plea agreement is defined in its totality at page 5 of our brief. Harches will be pleading no contest to the four counts charged in the information. There will be an open sentencing. There will be a joint request for a pre-sentence investigation. This is the least sophisticated plea agreement that any of us are likely to see. There was no...
Maybe quite sophisticated. It's just short.
Elegantly short. The terms of the plea agreement called for open sentencing. In the context of this case, open sentencing meant that the parties were free to argue as to the proper sentence. There was nothing in this plea agreement to prevent the prosecutor from arguing that the uncharged misconduct in this case was an aggravating factor, which would have justified a longer sentence.
That came in via the ex-wife's testimony?
And also the statements of the victim, the child victim. As a matter of law, the state circuit court couldn't be prevented from considering Harches's uncharged misconduct in imposing sentence if it chose to do so. The court had an evidentiary basis upon which to find that there were multiple victims. And the uncharged misconduct under Wisconsin law can be perceived as evidence of low character, which goes to rehabilitative potential and the need for public protection. As Judge Wood noted...
No Sixth Amendment argument made here. When you say the state judge can't be prevented from considering it, there is, of course, now a large body of law about that, but I gather no such argument was made here.
No. The state also, under Wisconsin law, could not have been prevented from keeping the allegations of uncharged misconduct from the court via a plea agreement.
Did he have an opportunity to contest those statements by the mother and the child?
Absolutely. He had the opportunity to testify or to make a sentencing allocution.
Contest them?
His attorney disputed...
I understand, but did he present evidence?
No. No, he did not.
Evidence he could have presented other than the denial that the attorney communicated, that he denied that these various other incidents had occurred?
I don't know what evidence he could have brought to bear. There's nothing as a matter of record that suggests what he could or couldn't have done. I want to go to Judge Easterbrook's point briefly. Even if the state somehow breached the plea agreement by incorrectly stating that Harches admitted the uncharged misconduct, that doesn't provide a basis for plea withdrawal. Judge Easterbrook asked rhetorically, is there a constitutional duty or responsibility on the part of counsel to interrupt? And the answer, of course, is no. The constitutional duty that was owed Mr. Harches here was reasonably professional, effective assistance of counsel, objectively reasonable under prevailing professional norms, and that's exactly what happened here. Defense counsel quickly, unambiguously corrected the misstatement in his own sentencing argument. There's no real dispute here. There's certainly no showing by the part of Mr. Harches that counsel's conduct in this case was professionally unreasonable, or, more importantly for the AEDPA, nothing here to show that the reviewing court, the Wisconsin Court of Appeals, misapplied or misinterpreted the controlling principles of law. I prefer to spend the rest of my time answering questions if the court has any. Thank you.
It's not. Thank you, Mr. Weber. Mr. Richards, how much time does he have? 1 minute?
Referring to this plea agreement as least sophisticated doesn't do anything to advance this. It might have been simple, and if it was simple, then all they had to do was follow it. We talk about there was a question regarding evidence in the record regarding contesting this. There was a denial, but the things that are put forth...
Was there a denial under oath or just the lawyer's statement?
Just a lawyer's statement. And there's nothing.
Why in those circumstances couldn't the judge give credit to those claims by the mother and the child?
Well, I think it's laid out fairly well in the record in this case that it was never discussed with the defendant that there was an alternative, that there was... The read-ins were never discussed or explained to Mr. Harches by his attorney, and as he so eloquently testified at the Mockner hearing...
But his lawyer knew, obviously, and told the judge that Harches was not conceding these additional charges. So why couldn't the lawyer, if he thought there was some basis for contesting them, have presented evidence?
I don't know why he didn't, and if somebody else was sitting there, I think they would have done it, but that's not the standard we're dealing with here under Strickland. It stands What did the defendant know?
I don't understand
know?
You.
I think that what we're doing is we're second-guessing, and I think that that attorney somehow at that point made a tactical decision, which
I don't understand. What tactical decision? If he had evidence to contest these charges,
I thought you were saying he was ineffective anyway. So well,
I am. On the sentencing, but I think that...
But you didn't argue he was ineffective because he didn't present evidence,
well,
did you?
Well, how this whole case started, and it's in the record, is...
But I didn't understand that to be your argument. Maybe I missed it.
Okay.
Are you arguing that he was ineffective because he didn't contest these...
Well, I think that...
There are two separate points, you know, whether he properly drew to the judge's attention that the charges weren't admitted, and second, whether... He tried to contest them.
He did not try to contest them factually. I think he sure should have, but hindsight's 20/20. When one looks at the record of this
whether
case...
Whether he should have depends on whether it was contestable.
Right. And what
and,
I would...
And was it?
I believe...
Was there other evidence to present?
What I would make as a quick argument, which is in this record, there was a suicide note that started all these things happening from David Hartches. In that suicide note, he specifically refers to the one victim... E, as he's going to kill himself when he's found, that's it. He didn't, as he's going to his maker, admit to the other three acts from his two other daughters and a neighbor girl. Right there is where I would start.
Uh-huh.
And he didn't do anything on that. And then we have the sentencing, and we're here today. Thank you.
Okay, well, thank you very much to both counsel.